You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, this is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, filling in for John Cryer as the host of this week's Undisclosed Addendum. This week, we're going to cover episode 14 of the Dennis Perry series. Now, in episode 14, we revealed that while it seemed like Jane Beaver had come forward with information about Dennis Perry in response to the TV show Unsolved Mysteries, she in fact came forward in response to the TV show Prime Suspect, which was offering a $25,000 reward. I'm joined today by two guests. First, I have my undisclosed co-host, Susan Simpson. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group. She's also the host of the 45th podcast, and she blogs at The View from L2. Hey, Susan, how's it going?
Hey, Colin.
I'm also joined today by Lara Bazelon. She's an associate professor of law and the director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinical Programs at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Professor Bazelon's book, Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction, was published in October 2018. Welcome to the podcast, Lara.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Lara, let's start by talking about your book, Rectify, which I had the chance to read, really enjoyed, and think that our listeners will really enjoy given its subject matter. And so this is a book about wrongful convictions, the effect that they have on everyone involved, including the defendants, their families, crime victims, and even prosecutors. So what can you tell us about your book, Rectify, and what led you to write it?
So I wrote it because I was interested not just in the exoneration process, which I've been part of as an attorney, but also in what happens after. It seems like we have this idea in the public that an exoneration is a happy ending where the exoneree rides off into the sunset. The pictures that we see, the exoneree embracing his lawyer, his mother, giving thanks to God, and people think, oh, the horribleness of this is over and now we can all move on. But actually, an exoneration is more like an earthquake. It inflicts massive damage, and there are just aftershocks that linger for years. So we're talking about an upended world where people who were branded as perpetrators and served decades behind bars are revealed to be victims. And then at the same time, the original victims of the crime feel like perpetrators for the role they played in the wrongful conviction, whether it was because they made a mistaken identification or even just that they prayed fervently for this person to die. So I tell the stories of these people in the book, and it moves kind of through a wrongful conviction to the reckoning that comes after, where these men and women connect with the most unlikely people in the world, each other. After facing each other down from opposite sides of the courtroom, the original crime victims and the exonerees and their families, some of them, are able to move past bitterness and hatred and use this shared traumatic experience to heal. They can form powerful alliances, friendships based on deep love, and many become advocates for important reforms.
Right. And a case that you mention in the book is one we talked about in the Ronnie Long series, which is the case of Ronald Cotton, right? Where this is also an example of the victim and the defendant coming together.
Yes, exactly. And actually, Jennifer Thompson and Ronald Cotton are characters in the book, in Rectify, because it's really their story that kind of sparked this movement to replicate the practice of people on these opposite sides coming together. And Jennifer Thompson founded an organization called Healing Justice, and that is primarily what they do. They hold these remarkable retreats where they bring together crime victims who survived terrible, terrible events, their family members, exonerees, and their family members. And they do these circle exercises, these retreats where they share their stories and they go through their own experiences and they're able to see an exoneration from a 360-degree perspective, learn a lot about what happened on the other side that they didn't see, and really work through the trauma together. I've experienced it firsthand because I was able to go to one of the retreats, and it's just so moving, the kind of healing that can take place and also the relationships that form afterwards between the people who participated.
So Susan, that takes us into episode 14 of the Dennis Perry series, because we know that eyewitness misidentifications are the leading cause of wrongful convictions. They play a role in about 75% of cases that led to DNA exonerations. And as we noted in the episode, we have this Supreme Court case, Stovall versus Deno, and it says that single suspect identifications, which was done for Dennis Perry, have been widely condemned and seen as unduly suggestive, but they're not necessarily unconstitutional. And so in this case, obviously, this is what the authorities did. What do you think that they should have done in this case, given the unique circumstances?
I don't think you can say it's obviously what they did, because there is a lot of uncertainty about what actually happened here. Remember, one of the eyewitnesses says that Bundy never showed her any photo at all, to her recollection. And it's very unclear if he did show her a photo, how that actually took place, or what photo it was, or what was going on. But what did happen is a private person, Jane Beaver, went to her house and showed her this photo. So even if it's not a constitutional issue necessarily, because it's a private party doing this on their own initiative, the same problem still exists in terms of like factual reliability, because that photo was in her mind and that's what she remembers seeing. So yes, years later, when she is at the trial for this guy in the photo, it's going to affect her testimony.
And Laura, have you ever seen in your years of defense work a case where there was this private citizen who, before the police went to eyewitnesses and got them to do identifications, that they had actually talked to these witnesses ahead of time?
No, I've never seen anything like it. It's remarkable, and it really makes you question the motivation.
Yeah, and specifically, if you're looking into that, if you're the attorney at trial and you learn about what was done here, what's the case that you're pressing to the jurors?
Well, I mean, we know that Jane Beaver was motivated by this $25,000 reward, or at least it seems like the evidence is pointing in that direction. And certainly if you're the defense attorney trying to shake an identification and show, as Susan was saying, that there was kind of an implantation in the person's mind of who the suspect was because a private citizen had intervened, you would bring all of those circumstances up to show the jury this is why this identification is not reliable.
Well, of course, for that to happen, you'd have to know about it. Here, they had no idea that there was a reward of that amount being offered, either Jane Beaver knew about it.
If they had known, I mean, it would have been an entirely different trial.
Hopefully. I hope it would have been. At the same time, there were other things that were pretty important that, for whatever reason, the defense did not think to bring up. But I'd like to think at least the reward they would have realized was that mattered.
And Susan, you and we mentioned in the episode all these impossibilities in Bundy's story. And obviously, this is a case where a number of years had passed. Is this something where you think that these could be explained away by mere mistakes? Or do you think that there was bad faith going on here?
So in this, if it was just based on what people told me now in 2018, I would have a different take on it. For instance, Bundy told me in 2018 that he had gone and shown the women, the church ladies, the two of them anyway, Vanzola and Cora, the Beaver photo. If that was all there was, yeah, he could have been wrong. That wouldn't necessarily, to me, I wouldn't rely on that. What happened here, though, is that in 2001, just a couple years after this happened, he testified to the exact same thing, which makes it much harder to explain away based on memory. Now, the flip side of this is that Bundy only took 6 pages of notes for his entire investigation, which means we have very little records to go on in the first place, and they're frequently wrong. So, you know, it's basically undocumented altogether what happened, which gives him a lot of leeway to, you know, change the story or say things that went one way when there's nothing to contradict him. In this case, what contradicts him is reality, and that's the fact that if his story is true, he could not have had Jane Beaver's photo when he went to talk to the church ladies. He couldn't have known who Jane Beaver was. He couldn't have shown that photo of Dennis Perry to them at all. It just can't happen. There's just no possible explanation for it. It's not a case of memory issues. It's a case of factual reality contradicting what Bundy says happened. Similarly, he also found Cora and Vanzola right off the bat before ever talking to either one, which statistically is impossible unless he knew about them in advance.
Yeah, and Larry, you noted before that big motivation for writing your book was this case of an individual cash register. And that was a case that seemed to involve both the issues inherent with eyewitness identifications, but also a good deal of misconduct. So You want to explain a little bit more in detail about the facts of that cash register case and what was so sort of jarring with what you found there?
Sure. And you're absolutely right. It was a combination of both lying witnesses and police misconduct. What happened was that an elderly white man was shot getting into his car and he was killed. And the theory was that it was a robbery. And the police, for whatever reason, and it's still not clear to us, focused their attention on our client cash register. And they ended up having a case that basically rested entirely on the testimony of two people. One, a woman named Brenda Anderson, who claimed to have seen cash running from the scene, and two, a guy named Elliot Singletary, who claimed to have seen the shooting and then chased the suspect for several blocks, somehow miraculously at full speed without losing his breath and not being afraid, even though the man was armed. And it turned out after our investigation that both of these witnesses were not telling the truth. Brenda Anderson wanted to give the police something because she had several pending serious charges against her, which evaporated once she cooperated, and the defense was never told about that. The prosecution also held back this memo that they had prepared when they were deciding whether or not to charge cash with the death penalty. And the memo makes clear that Elliot Singletary didn't see anything. And then, in fact, the true eyewitness was his wife, Patty, and in that he had not wanted Patty to cooperate, we believe because she was pregnant and he was worried about some kind of danger to her. And so instead, he took it upon himself to sort of make up this story out of whole cloth. And the memo that proved essentially that Elliot Singletary couldn't possibly have seen and done what he claimed to have seen and done was held back. On top of that, Brenda Anderson's story was proved to be a lie by her sister Sharon, who was with her that day. And Sharon and Brenda were on the street, not in their house, as Brenda had claimed. They had come back from stashing some Avon products, makeup and trinkets, at a friend's house. And they both were together and saw the shooting. And Sharon was clear that the person was not cash register. And I should add that they both knew cash from the neighborhood and also from high school. And the police interviewed Sharon. Sharon refused to pick cash's picture because he wasn't the guy. And rather than turn that information over, they buried it.
My family and I moved into a new home last year, and since then I have been slowly trying to furnish it, but it's not easy because a lot of furniture can be pretty expensive, or if it's not expensive, it's not well made. Well, you don't have to look any further for beautifully made, gorgeous, modern-looking furniture that is well-priced because all you have to do is check out Article. Article is Scandinavian simplicity. Again, beautifully designed, modern furniture. I got a gorgeous rocking chair. It's like this upholstered rocking chair. It's just perfect in the corner of my bedroom. It's where I'm going to be cozying up and reading a whole lot of books this entire winter. And what I love about Article is that they eliminate the layers of traditional retail. They can keep their prices low because they sell directly to you. There's no showrooms, there's no salespeople, just savings. And no matter how many items, every single order is shipped at a flat rate of $49. That's incredible. If you have ever ordered furniture, you know how much it costs to have it delivered. It costs an arm and a leg. Also, if you need some help getting set up, Articles has an option for in-room delivery and for assembly assistance. In-stock items can be expected in 2 weeks or less. And if for some reason you're not fully happy, well, they've got a 30-day return policy and the best customer service in the business. Now, Article is offering our listeners $50 off their first purchase of $100 or more. To claim this offer, visit article.com/undisclosed. That's all it takes. Just go to article.com/undisclosed and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/undisclosed to get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
Yeah, and so obviously some extreme misconduct in that case facilitates the conviction. But in addition to that, as we mentioned, you know, 75% of these exoneration cases are mistaken identifications. And a lot of them are, you know, lineups or photo arrays done in complete good faith by the police and prosecutors. And yet we have these misidentifications, especially in cross-racial cases. And Larry, you wrote about the cash register case in a Slate piece and noted that states like New Jersey and Oregon have begun sort of reforms in the area of what's done at trial when we have eyewitness testimony coming in. And so what are some of these reforms that you're seeing out there and how effective do you think they are?
So this is kind of crazy, but as I was researching the development of this law about cautioning jurors in cross-racial identifications, I came across the case that started it all, and it's a 1972 decision called United States versus Telfair. And the federal judge who expressed concern about this problem and suggested that juries be cautioned ended up being my grandfather. So when I saw Chief Justice David Bazelon, my mouth kind of dropped open. But then again, I wasn't surprised because he was very prescient in his views and an extremely progressive judge. So what he said in this opinion is that we know it's a problem and that empirical research shows something called own race bias, which means we're much better at identifying people in our own racial group than those outside of our racial group. And he proposed this instruction be given to juries, essentially telling them that and cautioning them in cross-racial identification cases. That was in 1972. And since then, a minority of jurisdictions have adopted that rule, including, as you say, recently in New Jersey and also Oregon. And actually in California, we have that instruction as well.
Yeah. And, you know, Susan, we have these instructions. We have sometimes experts being allowed to testify. Do you think that would have moved the needle in Dennis's case, or do you think that the deck was sort of stacked against him and it wouldn't matter even if the jurors were cautioned about the issues with the eyewitness identifications here?
You know, cross-racial IDs are obviously part of the story. I almost think it's less significant, not that it didn't matter. It's just so much else was horribly wrong and not addressed that that was just adding one more thing to the stack. Here, I think, I mean, the single photo ID to me is much more of a contaminating factor than even the cross-racial identification, as well as the age, as well as the fact there's this composite image that the witnesses seem to be referencing. When they talk on the stand, the witnesses often seem to be saying it's not that Dennis Perry looks like the guy I saw in Rising Daughter. They're saying the photo of Dennis Perry that Jane Beaver had looks like the composite image that four of them made together. So they're not comparing, I mean, even the comparison they're doing is different one from what, well, one ought to be done, and two, it has no relevance to the guilt or innocence whatsoever. So yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have an expert on cross-racial IDs at Dennis Perry's trial, but I think they needed to start by at least even the basics of examining these IDs and how they happen. Starting with actually if Vanzola Williams had ever even seen the photo since Jane Beaver came to her house. For whatever reason, everyone seems to assume that Vanzola and Cora are just confused, are wrong about things that contradict Bundy's story, and they don't really push back on it. They don't really seem to consider the possibility that actually, wait, maybe Vanzola and Cora are right here, and maybe it's Dale Bundy has a story wrong.
And if I could just jump in here, it just seems like we've been talking about best practices for how to conduct lineups and eyewitness identifications and best practices for witness testimony. This case seems to me like the worst practices. If you could conceive of the worst possible way to conduct an eyewitness identification, it would be the way it was handled in Dennis Perry's case.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing was done right.
I mean, the first ID done in this case was Jane Beaver taking a photo of Dennis Perry, going to Cora Fisher's house and showing her the photo and saying, this man told me he killed a couple black people. That's like the most suggestive you could possibly be on every single plane. It's awful.
And from that moment on, the image is implanted in Cora's mind. And then when she sees it later in her mind, that's the guy. And it was basically suggested to her by Jane Beaver. So that's complete witness contamination right there. Then you get to the fact that it was a single picture that was shown rather than an array or even, you know, a series of pictures sequentially. And then you get to the fact that you have this motivated private citizen. And on top of that, that it is people who are African American being asked to identify someone who is white. And I think if there had been someone at trial who could have explained all of these things to the jury and why they are flatly inconsistent with how a reliable identification happens, it would have made a difference, particularly because when an eyewitness says that's the guy, there is no more powerful kind of testimony, really, other than the person actually confessing.
Well, in this case, you also have other eyewitnesses. There are many women in the church that night, and you have at least two of them who, based on all available information, would not have identified Dennis Perry had they been asked to. You have one eyewitness who told the police before trial that the composite image that was so damning to Dennis did not look like the killer, and who was never actually shown Dennis's photo. And you have another one who identified someone else as the killer. And I think if you'd had the two of them testifying, at least had more witnesses on the stand and had some explain that, no, Dennis Perry does not look like the guy they saw, perhaps that would have been enough by itself to contradict or to, you know, to refute the evidence from the two eyewitnesses who do identify Dennis, and their contamination in their memories wouldn't have mattered at all.
Yeah, and I'll add an update on a case we covered on Undisclosed that has these issues as well, and that is the Ronnie Long case. And this is the case of the man in Concord, North Carolina, an African-American man who was accused of breaking into a home and sexually assaulting a woman. And he's been in prison for about 42, 43 years. And this had, you know, Larry noted, this is sort of the worst case scenario for eyewitness identification. I think the Ronnie Long case is sort of just up there. That's the case, again, where they had the victim come to a courtroom in a disguise with a wig and glasses and identify Ronnie Long in the courtroom. And as an update to that, that case is hasn't been scheduled to date yet. There are going to be oral arguments in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. And there are actually a couple of amicus briefs, one dealing with the forensic evidence and eyewitness identification issues. And so we will keep you updated on the status of that case as it continues up to the Fourth Circuit. An issue that was not involved in the Ronnie Long case, but very much was the heart of this episode, Susan, is this thing we've covered in a few different seasons of Undisclosed, and that is reward money. We covered it in the Adnan Syed case in season one, another case from Georgia, Joey Watkins. And so the big discovery, Susan, that you've made here is everyone thought that Jane Beaver came forward in response to Unsolved Mysteries. It turns out she came forward in response to Prime Suspect and this $25,000 reward. And so you touched upon it a bit in the episode, but can you sort of go through in more detail your process of figuring this out and the efforts you've made to find this episode?
I've done everything I can to still come up empty. That's not demoralizing. I still think we'll get in the end, but I learned in the first place that like TV shows can just stop existing, which kind of blew my mind. Like there are whole series of TV shows people liked and watched and were played nationally that you could never, ever watch again. I think I just kind of assumed that like all TV shows have had an archive somewhere. Like surely someone kept a copy of that, but it's not the case. And I can just only hope that this show, Prime Suspect, is not one of the lost ones, or at least not completely lost.
Yeah, and our point here, Susan Wright, is not just that this has an impact on Jean Beaver's testimony when she said, but also we seem to be missing all these tips that came in response to the Prime Suspect episode, other than the sort of the brief notation. And any number of witnesses who testified might have seen this episode, and we just don't even know the content of the episode and how that could have sort of altered their memories, right?
Yeah, and it's very possible that in their minds they think they saw Unsolved Mysteries. I'm sure after 10 years it all starts to blur together. So we don't even know which TV show any witnesses watched. Of the ones that have seen a show about it, who knows which one it was? Because Unsolved Mysteries was a big show, obviously, but in its day, Prime Suspect had a really wide audience too. They had something like 100 apprehensions of suspects based on stuff that was on Prime Suspect. So they had a wide audience. They were successful in getting people to call in tips and to call in information. I mean, just who knows what came in to that show? And all we have is this one letter left that must have gotten tucked in with the rest because it was not through official Prime Suspect channels. It was through a letter that was literally... The letter was like actually addressed like Sheriff Camden County, Georgia, and that was it. And somehow it made its way down there. But presumably because it did go straight to the sheriff's office and did not get routed through Prime Suspect, that's why it survived when all these hundreds of other tips did not.
And Larry, in all your years of criminal defense work, how often did reward money come into play in terms of witnesses in the case or you trying to figure out where reward money might have gone?
I didn't ever handle a case that had reward money. Most of the cases that I handled, the incentives ended up being that the witnesses were trying to work off their own cases. And so were testifying in the hopes that they themselves would be able to get out from under the system. But in the cases that I have researched and read about, reward money is extremely motivating and not always in the most positive way. And $25,000 is a lot of money. And it was truly a lot of money 18 years ago.
Yeah. And I mean, for both of you, you know, obviously we have organizations like Crime Stoppers, we have TV shows, we have people offering this private reward money. What are your thoughts? I mean, obviously, this is always going to be a factor in the criminal justice system, whether it be plea bargains, whether it be immunity, whether it be money. Is there a better way we could address this in the criminal justice system that's not currently being done?
I'm not going to go quite far enough to say that I don't think reward money should happen. I'm growing steadily more disillusioned with it with every case we get. It seems like half of them involve extremely unsettling practices with rewards and payments being made out to witnesses. But at a minimum, it needs to be open. The reward needs to, it needs to be public knowledge what the reward is, how it's getting paid, and who it got paid to if it got paid. This whole idea of secret awards, I know that there's reasons for that in terms of like Crime Stoppers and when I have people come in anonymously. I don't think that's compatible with justice. We've seen too often that that is used to run around the justice system to claim it's a private party so they're not subject to disclosure rules. I no longer see a way that you can have that kind of private reward setup that's compatible with due process.
Yeah, and how about you, Lara? Is there any thought you have about what we can do to either regulate these or at least have them done in such a way that we're protecting the people who are giving these tips, but also protecting the defendants who are having people testify based upon financial incentives?
Supposedly, we have a check in place to balance out these competing interests, which is that we want people to come forward with relevant information, but we also want people who are accused to have a fair trial. And that's the Brady rule, which requires that the prosecution turn over any material that tends to be inculpatory of the witness who's testifying, impeaching of them, or tends to exculpate the defendant. And in this case, we're talking about information that tends to perhaps impeach the credibility or cause a juror to question the credibility of a witness, that they came forward in exchange for reward money, or they came forward in exchange for a lighter sentence or having charges dropped. And so one would hope that jurors are told this and they weigh that in their assessment of the witness's credibility. And it's something that defense attorneys can hammer home on cross-examination and in closing argument. But all too often, as in this case, what happens is that that evidence or that information is hidden from jurors. And so they don't know and they can't properly weigh the testimony against the impeaching information because they don't have it.
For many of the jurors, it seems like the question they didn't think there was another answer to is why for Jane Beaver? Like, why would this woman do this? She had no skin in the game. I mean, obviously she might not like Dennis because she didn't like invading her daughter, but whatever. That's not going to be enough to throw a testimony out. Why would she have done this unless it was true? Well, it turns out there's a very good explanation that I think for the jury might have answered questions they had that they felt could not be resolved based on the info they had.
And Susan, bottom line, you know, we touched upon this in the episode. We have this individual, Lawrence Edward Brown, and it seems like his story and potential involvement in this crime is very similar to the story that Jane Beaver tells about Dennis's involvement. And so if we get our hands eventually, hopefully, on this prime suspect episode, and it's telling this Lawrence Edward Brown story about borrowing money and drugs, how convinced are you that Jane Beaver sees this episode and just superimposes those facts presented in the episode onto Dennis?
If that's the case, I will be completely convinced. There are other, again, it's Waverly, it's small, everyone gossips. It is possible there are other ways that Jane Beaver heard the story, but it is so incomprehensible to me that two different witnesses or two different suspects in the case could have the same sort of unusual supposed motivation to commit a murder. I don't think I've ever heard of a case. Well, I'm sure it's happened, but it's not a common motivation to have someone ask for a loan, be turned down, be so angry about it, they go resort to murder. And the fact that Beaver's story matches the one that definitely exists long before Beaver came forward, to me, is a red flag that she borrowed the story. She didn't come up with it. It didn't really happen. She borrowed it from what people were saying about Lawrence Brown and his attempts to borrow money from Harold Swain.
And Lara, given your extensive defense, Rick, I wanted to touch upon a broader issue in this season beyond this individual episode. And that's what we've talked about with Dennis Perry agreeing to waive his appellate rights in this case to avoid the possibility of the death penalty. And we've seen this in defense around the country, the rise in these appellate waivers of rights at both the plea bargaining process as well as in the sentencing process. And people have tried to carve out exceptions, and there's been questions on appeal about how much these can be enforced. What's your overall take in terms of what you've seen and what you think about these waivers of appellate rights?
I think, quite frankly, they're unconscionable. It just shakes me to my core to think that Dennis Perry, facing execution, was told, you have a chance to spare your own life if you promise never to challenge your case. And it's almost impossible to think that that wasn't just an incredibly coercive and coerced decision, as it would be for any rational person, terrified thinking about their own death at the hands of the state. So to me, these kinds of appellate waivers are just horrific and should not happen.
And there was no time for thought here. It was like immediate. He's convicted, has the biggest blow of his entire life, and he's got half an hour to decide. And he can't talk to his family. He has to talk to his family. He's turned down. He's got to decide then or never. Like, you're going to do this. We'll be right back.
There are a lot of reasons I'm a big fan of SimpliSafe home security, but here's one of the biggest ones. SimpliSafe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If a storm takes out your power, well, SimpliSafe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, SimpliSafe is ready. Say they destroy your keypad or siren, SimpliSafe will still get you the help you need. Sure, maybe it sounds like overkill, maybe you don't need to be ready for every single worst case scenario, but that's the whole point of trying to keep your family safe, and that's what makes SimpliSafe's home security system so great. It is always ready. Now, SimpliSafe could cost an arm and a leg, but it doesn't. Instead, they only charge you what's fair. 24/7 professional security monitoring is just $14.99 a month, and there are no contracts and no hidden fees. I recommend SimpliSafe to everybody that I know, and you have got to check it out. So go to simplisafeundisclosed.com today. That's SimpliSafe, spelled SimpliSafe, undisclosed.com, to protect your home and family today. SimpliSafeundisclosed.com.
You know, and Susan, obviously, we, especially you and the Georgia Innocence Project, have uncovered a good deal of information in this case. You know, overall, if he didn't waive his rights in this case, do you think this is a point at which he would have had his conviction thrown out, or do you think that there's still issues that would have prevented a successful appeal at this point?
I just think it'd be totally different. I don't even know how it'd look like, because he would have had a quicker appeal. He would have had quicker attention to his case. And I mean, without the passage of all these years, I think that could have made a huge difference. I mean, on the flip side, if he hadn't done that, he could be dead today. He could have been executed by now.
Yeah, that ties into something that we've covered on this podcast. And Larry, you cover it in your book as well. And that is, you talk about these cases from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, the Anthony Wright case, which helped us a great deal, and the Willie Vesey case we covered in Undisclosed, and then the other Undisclosed case, Sean Thomas, which you talk about, where the conviction review in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, threw out his conviction. And so given that Dennis Perry has waived his appellate rights, one of the few possible avenues he has for relief in this case would be if the jurisdiction creates a conviction review unit. And we've seen, again, another trend in this country is the rise in these conviction review units, and they've gotten mixed reviews and different results. What's your take overall about the rise in these conviction review units and what they're getting right and what they're getting wrong?
So I think overall, it's an incredibly positive development. The most effective ones, so for example, the ones in Brooklyn and Harris County, they have exonerated scores of people. On the flip side, there are what one expert called CRINOs, conviction review units in name only, and they basically are just window dressing and don't actually do any real work. They're more just a public relations tool. But a true conviction review unit works cooperatively with the other side, defense counsel or the Innocence Project, and they reinvestigate the case from the beginning in a fair-minded way. And it would be amazing were that to happen in Dennis Perry's case. But what it actually requires is that prosecutors take a step back, and instead of reflexively insisting and doubling down on a conviction that appears to be dubious, instead come at it from a place of there does now appear to be some doubt and let's get to the bottom of the matter. What's ironic is that the prosecutor's responsibility, their ethical responsibility, is to seek the truth. They're called ministers of justice. But too often, prosecutors get wrapped up in this idea that their real mission is to convict. And once they convict, maintain that conviction. And they adopt a kind of win at all costs mentality. And so as long as that's the dominant thinking, it's very, very hard for innocent people to get a fair hearing.
And you had a piece in Slate recently, maybe sometime in the last year, about sort of these prosecutors who cling to these wrongful convictions and fight against them tooth and nail, right?
Yes, I call them innocence deniers.
Yeah, and we've certainly seen our share of innocence deniers in this show, Susan. And in addition to that, we've had our own dealings with the conviction review unit in Philadelphia. You spoke to Andrew Welbrock of the Philadelphia CRU in connection with the Terrence Lewis series. And we have Terrence Lewis, Willie Vesey, and Chester Holman all currently before the CRU. You know, what's your take, Susan, on the CRU phenomenon and what role you think that they can play in rectifying wrongful convictions?
I maintain my skepticism that, at least as a generalized global model, that CRUs can always work. They do work sometimes. There are some examples that where they are absolutely functional units doing what they should do. I have trouble thinking that can be trusted because, you know, in the end of the day, it's still inside the prosecution office. They still have that conflicting pressure. People who want to have their careers work out are going to have pressure not to buck the system, not to buck their bosses, not to piss off their colleagues. And while in some jurisdictions they've proven they have the independence and ability to make that work, I don't think most of them are going to succeed in that. It's just unlikely to me. That said, having them is better than the alternative, so it's not like my skepticism warrants like giving up on the idea. But I don't know. I do have reservations about it.
Well, I think, you know, you can design them to be more independent. And actually, the Philly Conviction Review Unit is a really great example, because under the former prosecutor who created it, R. Seth Williams, who is now doing 5 years in prison on corruption charges, the review unit was a complete joke. And it was run by a veteran homicide prosecutor who really didn't believe in the concept of wrongful conviction and didn't undertake any serious review. And there was a long chain of command, and the cases basically went nowhere. And then once Seth Williams was indicted and stepped aside, the unit really was revamped. And under Larry Krasner, who, as you know, is one of the most progressive district attorneys in the country, it is truly independent. It's run by someone named Patricia Cummings, who is a former defense lawyer and also ran a successful unit in Texas. And it's really dedicated to the mission of finding the truth. I think it also helps that they're looking into cases that they didn't preside over, right? So Krasner's new, and it's not like he obtained these convictions or Patricia Cummings obtained these convictions, and she's someone who's coming in from the outside.
Yeah, it can work. I think that there's like, for me, it seems like there's a pattern here of the units that do work. One, they're in major cities where there's a lot of people. And in terms of like connections to the case, prosecutors are usually many degrees separated from either when it happened or what happened or who was involved. And there are also places sort of with progressive criminal justice reform in general going on. I think that model is hard to apply to, say, Camden County, where you have the same prosecutors there for decades, and they're really, you couldn't get that independence. Just as a practical matter, I don't see how you could effectively do it. And especially when, in the case of where, like, Camden County, where everyone knows one another and same people involved for decades on end, I just think the simple human emotion of not being able to confront the idea that you sent an innocent person to prison or possibly to die, I mean, that denial and that desire for that not to be true can be a very powerful motivator. And without some way to separate the person making the decision from that, those people feeling those things, I don't think it's going to work. And Camden County, I don't see how you make that happen.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I'll note, I just saw the news of this, I think yesterday or 2 days ago. There is, in North Carolina, we talked about it in the Ronnie Long and the Pam Lanier series, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission, which is a statewide commission made up of various different actors, and they review cases of wrongful convictions. And for the most part, they've been pretty successful and led to some exonerations. And I just saw that in New Jersey, they've proposed a similar statewide commission. Yeah. So
I definitely favor that.
Yeah, it sounds good in theory. I haven't looked at the details yet. I'm not sure if the bill actually has too much in the way of details, but I'll be very interested to see how successful that is as a sort of a slightly different approach than the conviction review unit, but I think something that's potentially quite successful. I wanted to touch upon one last note before getting to a couple of listener questions. And, you know, Susan, you've noted this, including in this episode. This is a case where the prosecution, the DA's notes, made it look like they thought that Jane Beaver was a pretty strong witness. And the defense didn't go too hard after her at trial. And some of that might be they didn't have information on the reward money. And we discussed the potential psychological issues earlier. But, you know, just based on what you think the defense attorneys knew at the time of trial, do you think that they took the right approach in cross-examining Jane Beaver?
They dropped every ball there was to drop. It's hard to reconstruct a case. And hindsight is 20/20. And even with that and trying to look on it with the forgiving sort of nature, knowing that, you know, I'm looking in hindsight, I can see what happened after that. And they're making decisions, you know, at the time, not knowing how things are going to play out. It is hard to understand why they did what they did. I don't know if they just missed the facts. I don't know if they thought they were better off taking a soft approach with her. Although apparently that didn't work if that was the plan, because attorney's notes from the prosecutors suggest that, quote, they were not being very patient with her. So they were coming off badly, as if they were harassing her or, you know, being unpleasant to this brave witness to a crime, which would not have helped their case any. I don't know. I've wondered a lot about it. I don't have a good explanation. I don't know that one exists. But even just little things like what your own defense investigator found, you should get into that. Like, if you have Cora Fisher saying, Jane Buer came to my house and told me that her daughter had a child with this man, okay, that's a problem. It means either Cora Fisher or Jane Buer has some serious credibility issues. And it doesn't matter which one, because either one helps your case, so let's go explore that. Or when Cora Fisher says that Jane Buer told her that Dennis Perry confessed after the fact, that's huge. I can't imagine a reason why they wouldn't want to try and get... I mean, okay, yes, you don't want to be like, oh, look, my client confessed. He didn't tell in advance. So it's a delicate line to walk. I get that'd be a tricky sort of thing to approach, but I think the benefits there are so outweigh any risk. I don't know why you wouldn't do it. Because, I mean, at the heart of this episode is the question of why. Why was prime suspect nuked? Why was it erased from history? One answer is the reward, which makes sense. That is a good reason to try and put prime suspect down the memory hole. You don't want to have information out there that's going to tip off the defense that Jane Buer thinks she's getting some money. It might not just be that. That's one thing I would love to know and want to find more about. And I think there's a lot of suggestions in the file and the record and people I've talked to that Jane Buer's story has changed over time, and that whatever her first tip was to law enforcement, whatever story she came to them with in the first place, wasn't going to fly. It was not going to be credible, and they could not advance that theory. Through some process, her story improved, became better, but that's only going to work if you have a way of not revealing the prior story.
And Lara, in your years of criminal defense work, you know, how much were you consciously thinking about this balance where on the one hand, you want to legitimately go after a witness on cross-examination who has credibility issues, and on the other hand, especially for witnesses who might be sympathetic based upon their position in the case, worrying about turning that jury against you and your client?
It's always a concern, and I actually think it's maybe a particular concern with female trial attorneys, which is something else I've written about. I think we're judged under a harsher standard, but you have to be really, really careful when the witness is sympathetic to draw inconsistencies in a way that sounds reasonable and even sympathetic toward them. You don't want the jury to think that you are a bully or yelling or somehow trying to intimidate or coerce them into taking back what they're saying. So it is a devilishly crazy tightrope to have to walk, and you're consciously thinking about it as you're doing your cross-examination for sure.
Well, that takes us to some social media questions. And Lara, I'm not sure if you've been following developments with Marcy's Law, but if you have, I think you'd probably be the perfect person to answer this based upon what you've just done with Rectify. So this first question comes from Jennifer Baker, and she asks, with upcoming midterm elections, would the group be able to discuss Marcy's Law? In Georgia, this is Amendment 4 and would change the state constitution to include more rights for victims. This has overwhelming consensus between both sides, Democrats and Republicans. But what could this amendment do to the wrongfully accused? And so have you been following this development nationwide of this push for Marcy's Law? And do you have thoughts on it?
Well, we do have Marcy's Law here in California. And I have been noting that there is a push to adopt it and sort of a broader push to give rights to victims of crime and make sure that they are adequately informed and have the information that they need to be able to follow the case and feel like they're not being sidelined in the process.
So we have certainly legitimate concerns about the victims having a voice in victims' rights, but there's also concerns, as far as I know, and I haven't done too much research, that this might impinge upon defendants' rights because this allows, for instance, victims to refuse depositions and interviews, and some have argued that this interferes with the rights of defendants.
Yes, absolutely, which is a huge problem because, of course, you're allowed to confront and cross-examine witnesses against you, and presumably to have a fair trial, you need all of the relevant information to come in and be presented to the person who or people who are determining your fate. So exactly, I mean, it's this kind of potential overcorrection where out of concern and being very solicitous to victims and victims' rights, you are costing the person who's being accused of a fair process.
All right, our next question comes from a Twitter handle at Smarty22, I guess. Susan, has there been any thought about challenging the constitutionality of Dennis's appeal waiver in this case?
I can't speak for Dennis's attorneys. I don't know. My guess, and I don't want to link the attorneys to this because it's just me guessing purely, is no, because under current law, it is constitutional. I don't think there is there's no current basis for challenging it, and trying to make new law out of this, I don't think would be a very promising route. That's not to say I think it ought to be constitutional, but the current case law is very firmly in favor of it being so.
And Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we've had a back and forth over email where I was trying to get the copy of the appeal waiver. And my understanding is this true that at the current moment, we don't actually have the appeal waiver to actually see what the language is?
Well, it depends what you mean by appeal waiver. But yes, that would appear to be the current situation.
I just wanted to just add one thing, which is that Susan's right. It is constitutional. I guess the question is it constitutional under the particular circumstances of Dennis Perry's case? Because as Susan pointed out, he was given half an hour, was not allowed to really consult with his family. And it may well be that it just wasn't knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, that he just didn't completely understand exactly what he was bargaining for. And also, just given what was likely his emotional state and the stakes, he just wasn't making a rational choice.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, unfortunately, in this case, there was an attempt to do a post-conviction procedure based on that, and it was turned down.
And Larry, do you know, this is something that I haven't researched myself, and this is sort of piquing my interest. You know, obviously, the standard you're mentioning there is the standard for the entry of a guilty plea, that it has to be voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. Are you aware of any challenges or case law on the question of what it takes to have a valid waiver of appellate rights?
My understanding is that it's the same standard, that when you are waiving a constitutional right, the standard is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, well, that certainly has bearing upon the facts of this case. So we have this last Twitter question for you, Susan. This is from Kilroy's Carnival on Twitter. I'm sure Susan already thought of this, but if Ellie were given courtesy copies, maybe Seattle PD has it with reference to murdered woman in the same episode description. Also, maybe someone else in Waverly area / church community taped it. And so, right, this episode of Prime Suspect had these different cases it covered. Any thought that maybe these other police departments might have the copy of the episode?
Yeah. Now, remember, what we have to go on from that early December 1992 TV guide listing is that this show had three cases covered. One was youth counselor accused of child molestation. The other was rape of a Seattle woman in her apartment. And then the third was the Georgia Deacon case. So what Mike Hagedis, the host of the show, recalls is that they gave a copy of these episodes to the jurisdictions that had those cases. So theoretically, if we could find what else was on the same show as the Dennis Perry case, the Swain case, maybe they'll still have a copy of it. And actually, on Reddit, user KingVitamin1 has made a very compelling finding that we may know what the rape case is now. The youth counselor case, there's not even a jurisdiction listed, so I'm not sure how we can narrow that down. But the Seattle rape case, actually, I think we may know what it is now. I haven't looked into it in detail. I'm checking it out. But that's another avenue that may have opened up. So we'll see what happens.
Gotcha. All right. Well, that wraps up this addendum episode for the Dennis Perry series. Susan, thanks for joining me today. And thanks, as always, for all your hard work on the Dennis Perry case. We look forward to future developments, including possibly figuring out the Seattle case.
Yeah, I'll be back on Monday with episode 15.
And I'd also like to thank Larry Bazelon for joining us today. Again, her book, which I highly recommend to our listeners, is Rectify: The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. So, Larry, once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Mital Telhan, our executive producer, and the Georgia Innocence Project, a terrific organization that could use your assistance. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.